Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with David Allen Greer, Global Technology and Policy Authority and a well-known author. David, thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Dave, you've got an amazing career. You've gone through an amazing year, and now that you completed your term, what do you see as some of the top challenges as 2013 IEEE CS president?
Well, I have just indeed finished the presidency of the IEEE Computer Society. And for me, the big challenge was seeing the need of getting global expertise out there, getting people who can get their knowledge and their understanding of technology to the right place and the right job. And you don't really appreciate the role that international borders and countries have in all of this until you're actually out there on the road and seeing what's happening.
So what were the top challenges for the IEEE CS going forward?
Well, for the IEEE CS, we're really trying to help those, top-level, top-skill people do their work, develop the new projects, and get the teams they need. And I spent a lot of last year working with software engineering standards and with professional standards to help groups train the next generation of professionals, people who have graduated from college and are now in their first or second job, get them ready to be leaders for the next generation of projects. And the challenge is making sure that they have, those educational products that they need and the training that they need and are able to get it in a way that makes sense in their job or in their career at this time. And I've been in India, I've been in China, I've been in Japan, and each has different sets of challenges for getting those skills and that training in the right place.
So again, looking back, what would you say were your top successes?
Oh, I think the top successes for me personally was being able to represent the Computer Society and being able to introduce it into new places. In particular, I spent a lot of time with education ministers, or more often than not, deputy ministers, and science and technology and industry ministers in the various countries, and were able to talk with them about what the Computer Society does and listen to the needs that they have for their workforce and for the kind of technology they're trying to develop.
Now, you're a longtime participant and contributor to the IEEE CS, and yet there's nothing like being the president, so something must have surprised you.
Oh, a lot surprised me. I would say certainly the most engaging one was working in China and trying to build contacts and partnerships there and help strengthen the Chinese technical workforce, and realizing that institutions that looked just like American universities or American research labs had their own spin, and that we had to work to understand what their needs were and that they were often quite different than ours. In particular, I got to sit in on a number of board meetings, the boards that oversee various units of the Chinese Academy of Sciences or universities or their computing organization. And you'd partake in the discussions, and you'd listen to their needs, and all of a sudden you realize that they were making decisions in a very different way than where you were used to, and how they needed to get technology to the right people or get training to the right people or to adjust their workforce required a whole different group of people to sign on to it. I was just fascinated by it. For example, they're setting up in China a group of things that are called software schools, and they are independent of the standard university computer science curriculum, independent of industry, and it's an opportunity that a number of educators have seen to build new ways of training people, but they're not exactly regulated by anyone, and there's a bit of a discussion and a fight over who should do it, what should their curriculum be, and how do they relate to industry. And watching that discussion brought people I didn't anticipate being part of the discussion, people with different roles, industry taking a much stronger role in determining what curriculum was than I expected. And it's just fascinating to watch the discussion.
That's a fascinating kind of experience that you had. Are there any takeaways that could help what you're doing in the U.S.?
Well, I think one of the fundamental lessons that I learned quickly is don't assume you understand the organization you're walking into to see. It may look like something familiar, but you need to listen very carefully to understand first what their needs are. And I found things that you thought would be, well, they just need more workers, or they need better access to the current results on technology. And in fact, their needs were slightly different. That they actually had a great workforce. What they needed was training, or what they needed was to get standards and help their workers understand those standards better. And then the next step of who makes the decision, who has the vision to see what their organization needs and can get the decision made to help the group move forward. That almost always surprised me. And as I've gone, particularly in small companies, I do a lot of work in the U.S. with things that are in the first stages of startup. And you think you understand the model, and all of a sudden you realize that the personal dynamic is different than what you expected, and the way that they're making decisions needs to be clarified and developed a little more firmly, a little more maturely, so that they can respond to the needs of their business and their organization much more quickly and much more accurately.
You know, that's some really, really, really interesting kind of experiences you had and some great feedback for the audience. Now, you've had this really fascinating, I guess, surprising year in some aspects, and probably worked harder than you ever have in your whole life. What will you do next?
Miles.
So what will you do next?
That's a good question. I've seen, I think, that there's a real need in our community to move between laboratory, academic research, business startups, and established business, and in particular, help organizations work with technical talent. I think organizations, business organizations in particular, can be a little bit naive about how they get their technical talent prepared and working for them. And I think technical talent can be quite naive about how organizations work, and they can be sometimes frustrated that they're not being well utilized. And so my plan after this presidency is, you have a year of past presidency, which is not quite resting on your laurels as I hoped it was going to be, but it's not anywhere near as demanding as the year before. But try to do something, set up an organization or set up something to help those people who are working in technology get what they need to be effective. And that's what I'm looking at different options right now, whether it's working with a different organization or working in the IEEE or working on my own. I'm exploring different options about helping people understand how to work with the technical workforce.
That's just fascinating. Now, I know that you created a new video series. Now, what prompted this, and what are your SMART, and when I mean SMART, specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound goals, and then can you describe lessons from some of your videos?
Yeah, well, this is part of it. I'm developing a video series. One of the things that I have learned very clearly is that the Overview magazine article, something that I've written for many, many years, is no longer getting the readership it did and is probably becoming extinct, at least as we know it. And so I've been doing short videos, as I see that, as many ways, the replacement. My goal is to get a series that resonates with a certain class of people in business and in research laboratories. And the measurable part of that, obviously, is getting a number of hits and getting feedback that says I'm reaching an audience. I'm not sure you're aware of this. My brother is a journalist, and his paper went out of print, 7 years ago. He was always the least technical of the siblings, and our mutual father, who was in the early computer industry, would be quite proud with how much he has mastered the tools of internet journalism, and how he is on top of his audience, knows who he's reaching, and knows how to expand it. And in some way, those are the lessons that I am learning to master in a very different audience from the one he reaches. He reaches a general audience interested in world affairs. And I'm interested in reaching managers who are working with technology and who are either organizing teams or working with teams. And the viewership, the readers, the getting a series that's going up with a weekly update on it, and that those updates are anticipated, that they get a good sense of feedback to me and to the community at large. That's my immediate measurable goal, and that's what I'm working to complete by within the next 3 months, getting this thing up and in steady state form by June 1st is my goal.
Now, do you have a social media campaign as well, like let's say going into Reddit or some of the other social media channels?
I have been starting that. I certainly have been working with Twitter and LinkedIn because the market research that I have at my hand says that the kind of people I'm trying to reach use those two tools the most. And so I'm going to work with that. I have actually done interviews now with a couple people who may help me on brand management. And they have pushed me towards Reddit and Flashdot and the others. And my feeling is learn this business step by step and make sure that I can get, you know, these lessons, the insights. And what I'm largely doing with these videos is drawing on a couple sources. I'm drawing on the vast literature that's out there about managing technology and how technology fits into organization. And I am also pulling from interviews and activities that I have done. I spend a lot of time now at incubators and at small businesses trying to see what are the lessons they need and also understand the lessons that they have to offer, because their experience is quite fascinating. And then I'm fitting this into also the grand technical literature, which is often written as if organizations don't exist, and trying to use those lessons and the literature on technology management to pull together to help people understand what they need to do to meet the problems of today.
So what kind of tools are you using then to do the video? Something like Skype?
I'm using a Skype at times when I'm getting people into the video. I'm using the standard video production tools, and in fact, that you get for Macintoshes. In fact, one of my goals out of this is to, in effect, not do a big investment in production costs and learn to tell the story right. One of my brother's lessons is that when you're reaching people in this day and age and trying to do so quickly and timely, good storytelling and a clear point are the first and most important things in communicating to your audience. You want to have a certain quality of production, and you can achieve that more by insight than by huge investment. And my goal is to be able to have my correspondents and the people I'm working with, you know, have enough of a set of tools that they can give me a short video that I can incorporate into a larger lesson. And I think this is a way of building a community of people around the world, you know, here in Silicon Valley and in India and in China, who can tell me what they're doing, and we can incorporate it quickly. And you can see the results in a very short video that you would get during the day.
That's interesting. Now, what about IP? Are these going to be freely available?
These things are going to be freely available. We are setting these things up because in this day and age, media and transmission of media is driving the cost down to zero and driving your ability to get things out of it. And what we hope is that by doing this, we will have the companies I'm working with, the people I'm working with, they will have something to offer your organization, and that the way we will monetize this is, of course, coming in and doing some consulting, listening to your things, writing a report on what we see of it, and that's the process, which giving your organization some in-depth understanding of how these videos apply to you will be the ultimate way that we will be helpful.
Now, David, you're an author as well, and I know that you always have probably a book or two in the wings somewhere, so what are your next books?
Oh, I've got two hanging fire right now that I'm, you know, you work on and you think and you say at some point it's going to click and I'm just going to push everything aside. There's clearly one from the last year's experience that needs to be written. And it's basically a global view. And this is, I spent 6 weeks in India, 6 weeks in China, about 5 weeks in Europe, lots of trips to California, Silicon Valley, New York, New Jersey. And there's a picture there that's quite interesting about how this community works and how it talks to itself and the role that organizations like the Computer Society has in that. And I think there's a story there, and I've been sketching that out and working on it piece by piece. And I think that's the next one. The bigger one, which is something I have been pondering for some time, but it is becoming clearer to me, particularly as I've seen the way that leaders of technical organizations work, has been the connection between software and software system and the way we organize work. It's something that is actually a theme that you can stretch back through all of my books, but I've been seeing it much more clearly and realizing how these systems in some ways are the physical, although we know they're not physical, versions of ideas that we also implement in how we relate to others, how we coordinate our activities, how we set goals for ourselves, and how we plan for the future. And I think the discussion between those two sets of things, the software systems and the organizational ideas, makes for a fascinating discussion both of practical things, how you organize your company or your university or your laboratory, but is also, I think, a very interesting marker in where we are as a global civilization right now. And I think it'll be a book that will really sort of help us have a better view of ourselves and a better view of our position in history. So those are the two ideas that I'm working on, and they will be out soon enough.
Now, David, you are the hub of an ecosystem that's global and have been for some time, which means that you have a lot of intelligence feeding into you, and some of that is in your books and in your videos and so on. So I would say your best place to describe, maybe there's something on the radar or not on the radar screen perhaps, that's an upcoming disruptive innovations. Can you talk about some of these?
Well, some of the things that I have seen in the short run, in the next 2 to 3 years, are things that I think are well discussed in the press, and those are things like the big data and data analytics. Doing cloud computing, I think, has far from run its course, and there are some aspects of it, particularly as we get clouds that start talking to each other in general ways, that will further break up large organizations and allow groups to work in small, agile, and quick ways. I think the biggest thing, though, is the increasing use of a combination of machine intelligence and market incentives in large systems. And I think they're being used in consumer marketing more and more, but we're also starting to see them in organizational management, in the control of large systems like power grids and freeways, and in other ways that are engaging people in large-scale behavior where they can look at things and make the decision of what's best for them, and that the system as a whole tries to take those individual decisions and conclude what's best for the community. And that discussion between those two kinds of data I find fascinating, and the kind of systems that are being built up around them, I think, are going to be some of the next wave of major disruptive and innovative systems.
Now, again, sort of an extension to the previous question, you are at the center of all of this information coming in. So what do you see as the top growth areas or regions worldwide?
Well, I think many of them are places that we know and understand. The two things that have been fascinating me have been India and China. I think India has tremendous room for growth when they get some of the issues with their workforce settled out. In particular, how do you train the middle tier? They know how to train the top tier workforce. They have good universities in India at the IITs. They send some of their best people also to American or European schools. And they have figured out how to do the basic entry level. It's that middle group that they're struggling to figure out. And I think once we see that, the India miracle will expand well beyond the Bangalore core and Hyderabad core, and will be a major force to deal with. And particularly, its mark in software will continue to expand. China clearly has a hardware side down that it understands better and is doing well on, and is trying to integrate that with software. And I spent a lot of time in the Haidian district of Beijing, and saw a lot of things where they are reaching out to try and unify those two activities, and don't have quite all the pieces figured out, because they're very different kinds of processes. They understand large supply chains. They don't understand as well how you assemble large software systems, large complex ones, and integrate them into an organization. And I think that's going to be the aspect that once they come to grips with. The third area that I haven't mentioned at all is beginning to see some interesting opportunities in Africa, both East Africa and particularly West Africa, Ghana in particular. I have a friend who is leaving either today or next Thursday, going back for an extended stay in Ghana to help develop businesses there that are in fact tightly tied to the European and American market. But they're operating there, they're developing systems, and they're deploying them in ways that expands the global market and expands the global consumer base in, I think, very creative ways in areas that have resisted having that kind of expansion. And I have another friend, actually, who's right now in Nigeria doing some of the same things, though she's a little bit on the periphery. And I think there's opportunity in Africa, and I think we're starting to see the point where they're getting enough of the infrastructure and enough of the trained people and enough people recognizing that there are skill and talent there. and we'll see how well this develops and advances.
You know, you've done a lot of traveling. You're an author. You do speaking globally. You sit on top of global organizations. You also a noted academic as well. All right, you know, I guess because you're at the center of all of this, are there any areas of controversy?
Well, I think the big area of controversy is one we don't really see and talk about very much, and it's something that has been with computing and with factory production forever, and that's what's it doing to the workforce? Certainly, there are people and there are groups of people who benefit tremendously from the technological changes, who master the technology and know how to set up businesses and organizations and restructure government and make it work for them. There are people for whom those skills are not obvious, who struggle to do it, and often get pushed to a level where they're not using their full capacity. As I said, it's been around for a long time, and in particular in the modern age, there are a pair of books from the 50s called Automation and Beyond Automation that articulate the problem. And that is, we have got groups of people who, in times past, a generation before, had the education and skill to find a good place in society where they felt they were making full use of their talents. And now with computers doing some of that work, they're feeling underutilized and certainly undercompensated and are not necessarily the people for whom the technology is obvious, nor ones who are particularly interested in pursuing it as a way of advancing themselves. And I think there are some interesting forms of technology that are going to come out and be helpful, things that allow us to think about problems in different ways that are beyond the standard tools we've had for the past 50 years in computing. But there are a group of people that could very easily get pushed to the side, and I think we need to pay attention to them and think about how do we engage the talent of these workers, of these citizens, and help use that to strengthen their communities as well as the world at large. And they're people not only in just North America, the United States, and Canada, but, you know, you see evidence of them in Japan, you see evidence of them certainly in Africa and India. And making sure that technology not only is pulling up the upper end of the echelon, but there are opportunities that go beyond that. And that controversy is openly discussed in some areas. Certainly you heard that discussion. I heard that discussion in India. And I've heard through colleagues that discussion in Africa. But it's something that we need to be aware of and just always thinking, how broadly can we design what we're doing? How broadly can we make institutions that help the world at large?
You know, that's really interesting. And just to give you a little bit of context of something that recently happened, you know, I chair something called the Global Industry Council. And about a month ago, I was invited to provide input or recommendations to a new U.S. bill, which in fact, it's going to be introduced next week, and which means that when people hear this podcast, it'll already be introduced. So anyways, it kind of addresses some of those areas that you talked about, and you know, they were happy to get the kind of input that we could provide, and I also reached out to the Global Industry Council itself members, and one of them actually flew out to Washington to meet for a morning with the people who were drafting the bill. But they took a lot of our recommendations. They listened and they took a lot of our recommendations, and it did sort of impact the direction of the bill and in giving it perhaps more weight. And but I thought it would address many of the issues you talked about, you know, sort of embracing sort of all walks of people and providing opportunities. So I think that providing this bill, once it's released and passed, will be a great benefit to society in the U.S., but I think it's a model for the rest of the world as well.
Well, good. I mean, one of the lessons I think we have learned about technology of the last decade and a half is that it not only supports large organizations, but increasingly it allows small groups of people to say, what's the need around me? And how can we organize to address it without worrying about what a large organization thinks? And to get there, to be able to use this technology effectively, there need to be skills out there. There needs to be an understanding of how we can best utilize it. and they're not always there. Sometimes when you're at a distance from the center, you're at a distance from skill as well. And I hope that we can sort of see ways of disseminating that skill and making sure that the globe has it where it's needed. And so we'll see what the bill does.
Yeah, it's interesting. And then I guess it just occurred to me that we've just been invited to provide comment as well on a new sort of body of knowledge for Europe. And we're going to engage there. And it sounds interesting. I think it'll have some of the same impact that this U.S. bill will have. Perhaps not reach the same levels that the U.S. bill will have, but we'll see what happens. Now, these next three questions are perhaps areas of controversy, or perhaps not, but I'd like to get your views on them. And one of them is the sort of rapid growth in free content. And, you know, term free content kind of hits many areas. I know that with the IEEE CS, there's probably debate about your digital library maybe freeing up the content there, but there's also television shows and recordings, so there's different kinds of free content. Anyways, what's your views on that?
Well, it's going to be the big challenge that we're wrestling with for the next decade or so. There is increasing free content, and there's different kinds of content, and we need to start understanding some of the things that values it, that puts a value that says this is good, this is not good, this is useful or not, and how we, you know, provide enough economic incentives to make sure that those things are out there. In academic work, there's I think a fairly stark choice that we're seeing, but I think ultimately there's a way for it, and that is we need research on technologies across the board, not only computing technologies, but obviously medical technologies, new technologies for developing urban infrastructure and everything else in between that, you know, has been well-researched, tested, and validated by people who understand the field. And in the United States, and as you probably know, in the last, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, I guess it is now, when we're recording, the United States has said, okay, government research funded by certain institutions with the government has to be provided freely to the public at large. And I think overall, that's going to be a positive thing. It's going to get more information in more hands. But the cost of completing that research, of having everyone comment about it and talk about it, and make sure that it's research that fits into the body of knowledge, that it's done correctly, that it's useful and valuable, we're going to have to figure out a way to validate that. And that's an issue that really does hit the IEEE. And we have been thinking about it now for about 4 years and have some solutions that I think we'll see a turnover and some churning, but we'll solve the problem. We'll be able to get the information to people freely. Once you go beyond that, there's general purpose information, things that we provide that's out there to help you understand the world better. It's not necessarily part of an academic structure. My videos certainly end up being part of it. General purpose magazines and other things. It is, in fact, going to be harder and harder to make money doing that, to sustain that as an independent operation. And so we're going to need to figure out ways of tying that to other activities to support the dissemination of information. And certainly, you know, one of the things I know is that while I live in a city with big libraries and lots of access to information, my ability to work as a leader of the computer society and a leader of the field has been the fact that I've had access to that kind of information easily and freely, know how to get it, know how to work with it. And so I think this is an issue that we're going to see, and we're going to see expanding. How do we make sure that kind of general stuff that you need for your daily work, understanding your community better, understanding the world better, that's out there and that is good enough that'll be helpful to people? And then finally, there's entertainment and things that we use that sometimes have instructional value to it, sometimes not. But they certainly are the stories that we tell ourselves that ground ourselves in our community and in our society. And it's not only things produced by Hollywood and Vancouver and Bollywood, but a lot of other things coming out. We have seen that in the process over the last decade or 15 years, that the opportunity of doing wide mass market, getting wealthy with wide mass market circulation, this has certainly changed, and certainly no clearer than in the music field. We may be seeing the end of the great rock stars, if you will. But that may mean that we have a different sense of music. It certainly does. And that it's much more local and is much more support. supporting ideas and values of different areas around the world. And if you explore what's being done musically, there's a lot of interesting stuff out there. Certainly as there was when rock stars ruled the earth. But it does mean that some of the most creative people need support and need ways of making money, of providing for themselves and their family, that we have not always clearly thought about. Music has a certain things that make it easier, but what do we do about storytelling, about videos, about fiction, about essays? And those solutions, those problems are awaiting creative solutions. And I hope as we move forward that we'll find ways of addressing
it. You know, it's interesting, you know, there's a sort of proliferation of information, and I guess you also speak to curation of that information, because, you know, how do you separate the noise from the good stuff, right? And and various groups are trying to do that, right? So curation is, is an issue that's becoming increasingly important.
Yeah, very much so. And you know, curation, we live in a society that, at least in North America and sort of the European drive, that really privileges people who create and says that that's the important contribution. And in fact, if you look closely at the way the world works, editing or curation is probably equally important. People who are able to assemble collections of ideas. There was a recent essay that I read actually about comparing the Beatles and Duke Ellington. And the author argued that both of them were not only very original people who thought of great ideas, but both were actually great curators. That Duke Ellington had great talent, and he was able to pull from his talent and see the great ideas that produced some of his best known and most important music. And the Beatles, of course, drew very, very heavily, not only from American R&B, but from Broadway tunes, from English show tunes, from all sorts of things, and as they eventually go along, from Indian music and other places. And the ability to curate, to see what's good and to put it in the place in your intellectual framework is very, very important, and we don't value it the way we should. And that, too, will be part of the problem of the next decade.
And then the next question in this sort of series that could be controversial is this sort of rapid growth in crowdfunding. And I guess in, what, April of 2012, Obama had the Jobs Act, the Jumpstart or Business Startups Act. And, of course, in April of this year, 2014, the equity parts of it, the equity crowdfunding parts of it should be put into place with
we
policies.
Hope. I mean, they were supposed to be in place a year ago.
So what are your views?
Well, there are two things. One, from having seen the startup world, I think there is a great deal of value in this, and that it should be able to help people move beyond that first step of, you know, funding your startup business off your credit card and moving it into a going concern. And in particular, there's now so many ways of getting skills in the fractions you need to get business. Small-scale crowdfunding startups, equity funds, could make a tremendous difference in getting small businesses going. The downside is, of course, as we have known ever since we started down this path, that crowdfunding, this kind of small-scale funding, has been around with us forever. And in the 1930s, we labeled it penny stocks, and penny stocks were outlawed in the United States and Canada as a form, as being too vulnerable to fraud. You show up in a town, you form a company, you sell penny stocks, you vanish, and no one has a lot of money in it, so no one's going to go after you. I think we are still looking at it just a little too positively without thinking of that. We've had enough now history with the Kickstarter and other non-equity forms of funding to know that there are problems and that nothing we can do will get rid of them ahead of time and remove the need for those engaging in these transactions to beware, to do due diligence, to pay attention to what's going on. But I do think that overall there's value in it, and in particular it allows communities to support things that serve them and without having to go to a bank or to a large scale source of capital. In, you know, North American history, a huge source of innovation for much of the 20th century were the machine shops that sprung up around rail yards, often in small towns in the western United States or in western Canada, because there were people who had a job and then they saw a need and they had the skills. And if they always had to run back to Toronto or run back to New York for capital, they might be stuck because they're trying to explain, you know, what you needed in Omaha to someone who didn't grasp it at all, and they may not have even had the ways to get into it. This new kind of funding will break that tie and allow local communities to respond more strongly to local needs. And we hope that it ultimately does so without bringing with it too many of the other problems that are potentially there.
You know, it's a kind of an interesting area. I mean, I attended the CES, the International CES in Vegas in January this year, and in fact was invited by the U.S. Embassy as part of a Canadian delegation. And I also attended the prior year. I was invited by another government from Europe, Eurasia, to help them as they sort of looked at this sort of tremendous event that's hosted in the U.S. every year. And, you know, in 2012, I thought, you know, there's very little of the companies I thought which are involved in crowdfunding, but I would say a third to a half in the something called the Eureka Park, which is all full of startups. I would say a third to a half are all funded through crowdfunding. And I was surprised that sort of the rapid acceleration just within 1 year. And then you hear, you know, just a few weeks ago, I guess now, Indiegogo did a Series C fundraising. I think it was about $40 million. And then Kickstarter itself is, what, about $1 billion in terms of transactions or revenue that's passed through them in some way. So, you know, just, and there's, what, over 700 platforms, and then you get the World Bank releasing a report last year on crowdfunding. I don't know, perhaps it's going to be disrupted. Do you think it's going to completely change how companies are financed, or you think it's going to be some kind of a merge between or the two working side by side, you know, traditional angel VC and crowdfunding, or is going to one replace the other, or what?
Well, I think they're going to work together, and they're going to end up working together very closely because I think they fill different needs. I was also at Vegas this year and saw that same evidence. I was at the engineering side of the CES, and I like to tell that I was a keynote speaker. Marissa Mayer, you know, addressed 35,000 people. I addressed 600. There's the difference. But I sat in the there was a reception room for the engineering, for the technical side of CES, and just had the stream of people and talking with them. And it was clear that crowdfunding was very much on their mind. But one of the challenges in starting a business is not just the technical idea. There are a whole set of skills, as we all know, that you have to hit with minimal competency. And one of the roles that angel investors do and the initial rounds of friends and family and things like that is it often brings people into your business that have some of that expertise, and since they now have some skin in the game, want to make sure that you're demonstrating that expertise as well. That kind of personal attention that you get from angels and from their boards and from their advisors can often be very, very important to an early stage startup in terms of reaching the maturity where it can stand on its own. Crowdfunding does not provide that in the same way. You're much more on your own making your pitch and getting it, and since no one has a large stake in it, no one's necessarily going to give you that same kind of advice. So I think that they very much are balancing kinds of activities. I know small businesses that feel very comfortable with their skill sets and know where they're going. And these are often businesses where someone has, it's either their second or third startup, or they have been part of other organizations and are a little more mature in terms of what they need for business skills, that they often use crowdfunding to delay that, getting a terms letter from an angel investor or from a venture capital firm that's going to require them to fit themselves into those organizations' structure, that they want to shape their product and their market early so that their vision is the one being implemented. And yet at the same time, I've seen other organizations that have gotten themselves so far on crowdfunding and done very well. And you say, you know, you really need to bring in someone who has operations experience to take you to the next stage. And at that point, you know, that's often an indication that they want and need and would benefit from not only the expertise, but the investment that would come from someone who would directly or indirectly provide that expertise. And so they're going to work together, and they're going to do different things, and people will make bad judgments about which one to grab at the right time sometimes. But I think done well, they allow a new organization to find its niche, and then get the skills it needs when it needs it from the bigger investments and the more traditional investments.
You know, we talked about this somewhat already, and you know, there are different types of crowdfunding. There's equity crowdfunding, there's donation and reward crowdfunding, there's also debt, convertible debt crowdfunding. Do you think that the IEEE CS, for example, let's say if you had a really interesting project and you needed to get some funds for it, maybe use donation-based crowdfunding as a vehicle for funding it?
Oh, I would think a donation-based with something like the IEEE CS would be quite appropriate. I'm not sure how we would quite make equity or debt-based work. But I could see, you know, for example, we have markets that we need to serve better. We're not helping Brazil yet right now, in part because of the language barrier. We should get more of our materials to them and have a better dialogue with the technical people there. If we could do a crowdfunding that would start some kind of a translation mechanisms and some way of getting a dialogue back and forth, that could be very, very useful. And I would think, given that we're a nonprofit, that the contribution kind of thing would be the most appropriate to do.
Now, the final question in this series of three is about digital currencies. And God, we just see so much news in the press lately about it. What are your views?
Well, it's fascinating. And I'm following it closely, and I actually have a student who's part of the Bitcoin team. And I'm listening to him, and he's a little more enthusiastic than I am. I think that this is part of the general trend of the last 15 years of breaking down and weakening some of the positions of traditional institutions, both companies and government institutions. I don't think either of those are going away soon. It's not clear to me that Bitcoin has solved all the technical problems. We know in the last 10 days they've been hit with something that's a clear technical glitch, although it may have been exploited by people who knew that was there and siphoned it off for their own good without and misled us all. But more to the point, have really learned the full lessons of currency management. We know that in the United States and Canada, we have, and most of Western Europe, we have a strong set of central banks and organizations that are there to provide and encourage liquidity. We know what happens when those fail, and we know the kind of intervention, certainly in the 2007-08 period, you have to do to ensure liquidity that could conceivably bring the business community to a grinding halt. It's not clear to me that Bitcoin has, well, it's fairly clear that it doesn't have any of that sort of activities, and they're relying solely on market mechanisms to support and maintain their currency. And also that much of the value in their currency right now is coming from speculation, that it's not a big transactional currency yet. It seems to me that as long as it is a speculative currency, there's not a lot of damage that's going to come from it. Once it moves into the greater sense of being a transactional currency, it'll be interesting to see where it goes. The major currency players have got a lot of stake in this, and I see it's going to be a long, hard discussion, and that the results are not going to be decided soon. I suspect there will be a role for a non-country-based digital currency, least of which for moving things amongst various country currencies and across borders. But I'm not sure that Bitcoin is necessarily it yet. It may be. But I think we're going to need a little clearer sense, a little more transparency about how liquidity is maintained, about what reserves one has, particularly if it becomes a transactional currency, and how it's going to interact with the other currencies of the world. So that's where I am at the moment, but it's going to be a fascinating story.
Now, David, you are an internationally recognized authority in policy, so that's why I'm asking you this question. You're the person. So what do you see as so what improvements should there be in policy in the next 2 years, and what would you like to see internationally?
Internationally? Just anywhere in technology?
Yeah, well, first of all in the U.S. and then also internationally in technology, yes.
Well, I mean, we've touched on so many of the subjects. Certainly, the U.S. is in, I think, the final stage of making sure that technical IP that's coming from government research is freely available, and I suspect we will see the final changes to that policy within the next 18 months, and that'll be over. I think some of the issues about the movement of of professionals, of IT professionals around the globe, the kind of things that we're seeing the WTO and others discuss would be part of the global policy changes. I think some of the sense of what we've got most of the standards out there on software engineering don't quite have them all out there on cybersecurity, and I think that actually is going to be the big global issue. But how do we deploy standards in those two areas to protect the global IT infrastructure, and how, what responsibilities do individual countries have for doing it? Because in particular, cybersecurity, one hole in the infrastructure is a hole for everybody, no matter what we think. And the alternative to it is the balkanization of our IT infrastructure, where everyone goes their own way and doesn't talk, and that does not help the world as a large. How we get those out and how we get those accepted. Europe is considerably further ahead than the U.S. on that, and I suspect that their model will ultimately be the one adopted. Some of the big holes that we're seeing, obviously, Russia, parts of the Middle East, India, and China, need to be brought on. We need to see some sense of what's the authority that agrees to these standards and how do they implement them. That's going to be a decade before that's done. And I think it's one of those things that we have some technology that will help support them. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we're talking about human organizations and how they implement the technology and how they manage it. And those are the standards that we need to see out there. And that may end up being done either in a multilateral framework, or it may end up being built up piece by piece with a series of bilaterals that eventually combine until we have a structure that supports enough of the global infrastructure that basically everyone has to buy on to be part of it.
David, you speak extensively, you travel and you work extensively, so you must have some additional stories you can share.
Oh, sure. I have lots and lots of stories. Several things include, because of where I travel, the number of times I've been on a plane and sat down and ultimately introduced myself to the person next to me and discovered, lo and behold, they were doing interesting things in technology that were certainly related to, if not directly touching, what I did. And the feeling that we're working the same air routes, if you will. Another one has been kind of on the small scale, have been my opportunities to see students and listen to their aspirations and what they're trying to do, but also the challenges that they face in moving from a classroom environment to an employment environment, and particularly to a new business environment. India was one of the places where I've talked to a lot of students, been to a number of student conferences. And, you know, in particular, there was one where we were sitting outside at one of the big Indian universities drinking tea with a group of students, and a cow walks in the middle of the tea house and starts sniffing around. And what it was kind of symbolic to me of was, you know, this is a world in which that's a common thing. And they didn't seem worried about it, and it seemed a very nice cow. But they've got to engage a world that now stretches to Silicon Valley, that includes the European major software centers, that goes over to China. And they've got to get themselves to think in a way that communicates with the rest of the world. And how do they get their organization started? How do they get support from their local government? And how do they deploy it globally is sort of the fascinating thing. Oh, I could just go on and on students. I mean, I met them in China and listened to their attempts to do it and how they have to negotiate a much more complicated set of government structures. I've seen someone who was a student in a small university far, far away from any technological center who had built for his senior project a new low-cost tablet computer. That was very clever done and used a variety of displays in different ways. And then turns to me and says, okay, will you get it made? And I'm going, no, we need to talk about manufacture and how you do this. And this is a huge step. Getting the technology right is one. Getting it to the next level is different. And you need to think about the different alternatives you have because many of them are quite hard and you're not going to be able to pull them off. And the goal ultimately is to try and get your ideas to be as useful as you can. And that has to be the goal. And all those conversations just spoke to me of a group of people who are very much trying to improve not only their own lot in life, but the lot of a community around them, people that they know. And that desire, I think, is a very good desire. And you just sort of want to reach out and make sure that they have the education, the technical tools, the community, the financing, and the national and the international infrastructure that helps them make the kind of contributions that they desire to make.
And then we're down to our last question, and it's an open-ended one, and this is where I turn the tables and I ask you, if you were conducting this interview, what three questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
What three questions would I ask? Very first one, without question, was, if you knew it was going to be this kind of year, would you have done it again? Would you have signed up at the start? And because to me, it was physically just a very, very demanding time. My memory of it, of the common theme, is sitting in a hotel room late at night doing something for school here, or getting a manuscript in through an editor, or finishing off a cut on a video to meet a posting deadline. And that physically was hard. Yet at the same time, the people that you met, and this sense of really changing the world, of bringing this into a thing where, into a place where the needs of more people were met, and that people who had no idea how this technology worked received its benefits, was really quite a powerful story and a quite interesting story. And I'm very pleased to have seen it in all of its breadth and all of the activity. The next one I suppose I would ask is, you raised the question of what's sort of the technology for the next couple of years. And I think I would really have addressed it as, what's the issue that we have to address for the next couple of years? And I think we've touched on those two themes, but I think highlighting them as the issues of the next couple of years are important. And the first is intellectual property. How do we make sure that people get the ideas we need and yet have some sense of balance and compensation? And we've got a variety of systems around the world. An American, Western European, North American kind of style dominates, and that may not always work, certainly once you leave the well-established industrial economies. And that kind of balancing dissemination and reward needs to be solved, I think, to really help everyone. And then we combine that with the issue of defending the global infrastructure. I think that actually is going to be a major, major problem. One thing we already see in the computer society is a very large fraction of, a growing fraction of our members are increasingly involved in it. 15 years ago, we would have said probably somewhere around 4 to 5% of our members are, and it's probably 3 to 4 times that now, that are dealing with cybersecurity, cyber defense, and supporting and maintaining cyber infrastructure. So I think those two things, IP and defending the cyber infrastructure, are the bottleneck problems we have to solve in going forth. And the last one is sort of, if I could change things right now about the world, what would I do about the technology world? And this comes from a conversation that I had with actually a family member. My family in North America is of Irish origin, but we have an African-American wing of the family. And I had a dinner with an African-American cousin and sort of talking about the role he had to get up into the technology world. He's more on the sales and marketing side of a technology firm in California. And the role that I had, and making sure that sort of aspect of engineering, of technical education, of technical careers, is freely available to all in equal ways. It is traditionally a career that people do out of, I think, a very strong and a very natural set of aspirations. They desire to make their lives better, their families, and their communities. It is also often motivated by fascination with technology and a bunch of other things. But as you travel around the engineering community, those themes, not always well articulated, are part of people's lives. In particular, in India, I was part of a panel for young engineers, and we were talking about it. One of the other panel members talked about her understanding of the character of the engineer, of the software engineer. And as we talked, that those qualities always seem to be there. Sometimes they seem to be shoved aside a little bit by other things that come out. But this idea of yourself, your family, your community, and the world at large are there. And making sure that people who see those goals, who have those desires, can be able to use their talents to achieve them. And that some of the limits are put by who we think can be an engineer. Sometimes it's requirements of education that computer society is probably as guilty as any of making sure they're there. Sometimes it's access to education, and as often as not, it's access to mentors, access to people who can guide them through, because particularly those first stages of the career. Because no matter how much we think we have all put it down in words or put it in videos or put it in a form that can go across wires and travel the world, at the end of the day, career after career, business after business, organization after organization is shaped by one generation reaching out across the border of time and helping a younger generation advance themselves and get the skills they need. And that's something that I'm not sure we do as well as we would like to think we do.
David, that was just a very great series of questions and answers, and very thought-provoking as well. And, you know, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this interview. You have a very demanding schedule, and you shared many of your deep experiences and wisdom with our audience.
Well, I always like talking with you because I enjoy the discussion, and I think you reach an interesting community, and that your perspective on what they need and what will benefit them is good and corresponds with things that I think are good and important. So I'm always very grateful to talk to you.
Well, it was a pleasure, and thank you again. And I'm going to close by saying I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with David Alan Greer, Global Technology and Policy Authority and noted author.